Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin. And Ron, this has been a pretty remarkable week. We have a president of the United States who, when he was called Barack Hussein Obama during the 2008 campaign, people said, "Ooh, that's a pejorative. That's a little
slur. You're trying to put him down." Yeah.
But in this week's speech to millions of people, if not billions of people around
hundreds
the world.
Hundreds of millions, I think we can say.
The mention of Barack Hussein Obama as the president of the United States even called himself was kind of a remarkable change in tone.
He was clearly trying to emphasize all of his points of connection with the Muslim world to whom he was appealing. He wanted to emphasize his own shared ancestry. He wanted to emphasize his understanding of the Muslim religion, talk about the degree to which he has always felt himself to exist across different lines of national identity, religious identity, even though he is a Christian. But he was explicitly saying that I have real roots in the Muslim culture and the Muslim understanding of God.
Now, is he reaching out or is he attempting to reach out to the Muslims around the world? Or was he also trying to send the signal to the Muslim governments of the world? Because there's a signal that has to be sent there, too. If we, the United States, believe in the ideals of democracy, and we say we do, many of our allies, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, things like that, are torturing their own people.
I think he was setting his sights very high in the speech that he gave in Cairo. He was trying to speak to the Muslim world. Also, I would say to the world in general about a new aspect of the United States being in the forefront, that we're trying to show a different face to the world in many different ways, and nowhere will the contrast be greater than in the face we show to the Muslim world. But he's trying to generalize it. He's also trying to address all those who are concerned about a change in American policy because they prefer where the United States may have been. That would be conservatives in the United States. It would certainly be many people in Israel. And he does not want to, in a sense, leave them behind. So, if you will, there was an enormous world hug aspect to this speech. There were a couple of specific hard things in it. But he's really only returning to pretty much exactly the same language on the settlements that we heard from Colin Powell back in November of 2001.
Of course, Colin Powell was not president of the United States.
But he was Secretary of State under the president. And you can see where the tensions were in the first term of the Bush administration. And, of course, he went out and was not part of the second.
On the other side of the coin, I think there's a threat felt by al-Qaeda. I don't think it's just a coincidence that Osama bin Laden had a little pronouncement this week suggesting that President Obama was waging war on the Muslim world and promising more strikes against America. The way it came off to me, at least, is that there's a sense of threat that we have a president of the United States reaching out to a Muslim world and perhaps crowding out the al-Qaeda message.
And indeed, I mean, Osama bin Laden sounded quite threatened by this embrace from Obama and immediately said any Muslims who work with the other side, talking about Christians, they were working with infidels. So obviously, we have not heard the last of Osama bin Laden, but here, as in domestic politics, it seems to me, Barack Obama has been fortunate in his enemies, that if he can isolate the enemy in the Muslim world as Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, I think they're on a downward trajectory. I think what's happening in Pakistan is making the Taliban less attractive to those youths around the Muslim world. And I think what's happened with al-Qaeda could also be moving in that direction.
But then
if Osama bin Laden is the other side, then I think Barack Obama comes out ahead, even in the Muslim world.
Perhaps, but at the same token, I could see the argument saying that perhaps the feeling of vulnerability would make al-Qaeda even more likely to strike out.
Exactly. And that's the danger. The danger is that in the moments of decline and weakness, those are the times when dangerous people are their most dangerous.
And speaking of dangerous people, I mean, there's a domestic danger we saw this week. I'm not comparing Osama bin Laden to the murder of Dr. George Tiller, the abortion doctor, but that is religious fanaticism, shall
it's
we
violence.
Say?
It's
violence.
Religious
violence.
The intensity, the passions that are associated with that issue in the United States, with a number of moral issues in the United States and all through the world, is one of the great struggles of our time. The connection between extreme, intense religious feeling and violence.
Now, look, there is a strong, vibrant pro-life movement who have
and immediately condemned this act.
Who have decried abortion from the beginning, who even decried what Dr. Tiller was doing. At the same time, I think it's an ugly reach to decide that since there has been criticism of abortion, late-term abortion doctors, that's what led to the murder.
No fairer than it would be to tar all Muslims with the brush of al-Qaeda.
Right, exactly.
But that is still the struggle and the political difficulty. And the reason we deal with it in a political podcast is because politicians, ordinary politicians who would much rather be dealing with, you know, budgets and ordinary decisions, find themselves at all levels of government, international, national, local government, having to deal with these volatile, inflammatory religious issues.
Earlier in the podcast, I made the point that I thought that because Al-Qaeda was nervous about the appeal of Barack Obama, that they may strike out. I was having a conversation this week with Julie Rovner, our health policy correspondent, who knows more about abortion politics, I think, than certainly anybody I know of. And she made the point saying some of the earlier murders were held during the Clinton administration. This one is held during the Obama administration. And Julie made the point that perhaps the extreme anti-abortion movement might feel weakened by a pro-choice administration that's going to ram, you know, abortion on demand down their throats. And she was wondering if there was some kind of a connection, not because there's a Democrat in the White House or a pro-choice, but because they feel threatened. And I think that's an interesting point to consider.
Well, I think that extreme forms of behavior from any political group, whether it's left, right, whatever, are more likely to happen at a time when they perceive themselves to be out of power and getting no traction, and they are striking out in some sense or another in frustration and protest. This, I think, is a dynamic that is at work in some of the congressional politics that we see right now. As we approach the possibility of a 60-vote Democratic majority in the Senate, and we should say that this week in Minnesota, the Supreme Court finally did hear the oral arguments in the Franken versus Coleman case.
And it does not look good for Norm Coleman.
No, it does not. And so we are more than ever expecting Al Franken to be named the winner there.
If you listen to what the Supreme Court of Minnesota had to say, they seem very skeptical of Norm Coleman's arguments. Probably within 2 weeks, Al Franken will be named as the winner, finally, by the Supreme Court. And according to what Tim Pawlenty, the retiring governor of Minnesota, said this week, that if they ask me to certify him, I will. And there you get the 60.
It seems like a ticket. So if we're at 60, that puts a almost unprecedented degree of pressure on the Republican minority, right at a time when they're going to be confronted with the health care overhaul plan from the president, right at a time they're being confronted also with a historic Supreme Court nomination of Sonia Sotomayor. So right at about this time, we would expect there to be some circling of the wagons and some pretty harsh talk coming from the Republicans in the Senate.
But the harsh talk may be from Republicans, but not from Republicans in the Senate. I think people like John Cornyn, people like Jeff Sessions, the ranking Republican on Senate Judiciary Committee, have been very reasoned and reasonable.
In contrast with some of with the talk show commentators, Rush Limbaughs of the world.
And Newt Gingrich, who calls her a Latina racist.
And he also has retracted that. This is a very interesting dynamic. There were a lot of extreme things said about her about a week ago, and now this week the fashion seems to be to step back and say, no, we're going to give her every fair consideration.
But before that happened, we had Tom Tancredo on CNN saying that La Raza, the Hispanic advocacy group.
He said it was a Hispanic KKK.
That's just...
All right. So a few people said a few outrageous things in an attempt to get on the radio. Let's just say that the Republicans in the Senate obviously saw that that was a loser.
Right.
The polls were not friendly to that. And so they decided she's going to get confirmed and we're going to look bad in the process. We've got to make our principled points and take our votes and take our shots.
John Cornyn, who's not only a member of the Judiciary Committee, but he's the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, had to wrestle with that. And I think he made the right call this week and said, look, ultimately, filibuster makes no sense. It would damage us Republicans.
I think the White House would love to see a filibuster.
Sure. And I think the Republicans in the Senate, the Jeff Sessions, the John Cornyns, others, know that it's a losing proposition. Let's vote against her if we can, but no filibuster and don't hold up the nomination.
One other note about the relationship between the parties right now. President Obama has chosen several Republicans for notable visible posts in the government. Secretary of the Army John McHugh, who had been congressman from New York, is a congressman from New York and is the ranking Republican on the Armed Services Committee in the House. He chose him to be Secretary of the Army. Chose former Congressman Jim Leach from Iowa, big favorite of many people in Washington.
A nominal Republican,
And a moderate to liberal Republican,
liberal
to be sure.
Liberal.
He's been named to be head of the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Don't forget John Huntsman.
And John Huntsman, of course, going off to China. Before that, Bob Gates to be secretary. Ray LaHood and so forth. All right, but a number of Republicans in either cabinet posts or similarly high posts. Some Republicans not so happy about that because they think that he's just cherry-picking these situations so as to weaken the Republican Party's candidate list for the next couple of elections. And some Democrats not happy because they think those jobs ought to go to Democrats.
Are only Republicans capable of being in national security positions? But it's very interesting that we have Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, coincidentally the former chairman of the Democratic Congressional Committee, Congressional Campaign Committee, as his chief of staff. But John McHugh leaving New York York 23, in the history of that district, it has never, ever elected a Democrat to that seat. But we also said that about New York 20 when Kirsten Gillibrand gave it up to become a senator.
Well, this is even heavier because it never elected a Democrat.
Never, right.
1872, it's been continuously Republican. Before that, it was not Democrat.
It didn't exist, probably. the point is, he got 65% of the vote when the last time he ran.
But Barack Obama got 52% on that same day. The same day John McHugh was getting 65% in the district. Barack Obama, Democrat.
But here's my point. Look, the Republican brand is terrible in a lot of places in the Northeast and New England, but John McHugh was elected when the Republican Party was somewhat respectable.
In the state of New York, they still had their identity.
My point is that remember what happened in 1994, that there were some Democrats, Southern Democrats, who will be reelected until they died. Once they died or retired, it opened the seat for the Republican Party. Democrats, perhaps, and perhaps that's Emanuel's thinking here, they thought that maybe getting rid of a John McHugh, who is very capable guy, very smart guy, knows military matters inside
and
out.
And was an opponent of the Iraq War.
Of the strategies.
Of the strategy. That's right. But he was very doubtful about the war and therefore, in some respects, fit the district's zeitgeist.
But now the Republicans have to defend a seat that they've had forever and spend money, which they don't have, in New York 23. And again, that could become another brouhaha, as New York 20 was when Gillibrand left.
Good news for Republicans in a couple of other places. How about New Jersey?
Well, the stronger Republican won the nomination. Chris Christie, the former U.S. attorney, will be the Republican nominee against John Corzine. The last Republican to win statewide in New Jersey was Christie Whitman. So obviously,
they like the Christies.
The Christies, right. And one sign that the Democrats are nervous about that is that John Corzine ran anti-Christie commercials during the primaries just to try to tear down Christie, but didn't do the job. Christie won the primary, goes into the November election against Corzine as a favorite.
Well, what kind of news is it for the Republicans that Tim Pawlenty has decided not to go for a third term in Minnesota? That goes both ways.
The problem for Tim Pawlenty is he wants to be president, and he knows that if he runs for a third term in 2010 as governor, he could very well be defeated. His numbers are down at home. He barely won in 2002 and 2006. And remember what happened to George Allen of Virginia. George Allen was looking at the presidency, but he decided to run for another term as senator and got killed, and nobody talks about George Allen for president anymore. I think Tim Pawlenty did the right thing for his future. I suspect he will run for president. I suspect he will be an attractive candidate. But had he run for third term in Minnesota in 2010, that could have ended his chances.
Do you think the same thing will hold for Sarah Palin in Alaska? She's got to decide whether to run for re-election in 2010.
There are people who say that if she has national ambitions, she may decide not to run. I suspect she does run for re-election.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elvin.
And I'm Ken Rubin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.